I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Mark Diamond, co-editor of the first book co-published by Jewish and Latter-day Saints publishers on Jewish and Mormon themes, Covenants and Communities. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom and Chag Orim Sameach, a happy holiday of Hanukkah and Chag Chanukah Sameach. It's the third day of Hanukkah today, which means tonight will be the fourth night of Hanukkah. Just as this has been a truly weird and mostly terrible secular year for all of us, it's a pretty peculiar Hanukkah, too. I'm thoroughly enjoying the fabulous Festival of Lights, but I must admit to missing my kids, only one of whom will actually be here for Hanukkah in person, and very much missing the large gatherings we usually enjoy with friends and extended family and congregants. I mean, I do make a mean latke, if truth be told, but part of the fun is enjoying everybody else's versions of this Hanukkah specialty, plus all the other tasty and magnificently unhealthy treats associated with our oil-frying time of year. Of course, Ashkenazic Jews relish potato latkes, not with relish, with sour cream or applesauce. Anyway, we love potato latkes, fried in oil, or even the still less healthy chicken schmaltz covered in applesauce, plus heavy brisket and tasty sufganiyot, a kind of jelly donut that's even worse for you than latkes. But don't think that Sephardic Jews are any healthier these 8 days, unless you consider treats deep-fried in olive oil to be so much better for you than things deep-fried in vegetable oil. Bunuelos are a favorite dessert of Jews from the Mediterranean during Hanukkah, deep-fried pastries flavored with orange and covered in honey and powdered sugar. And they also batter and fry cheese for a dairy meal before eating bunuelos at this time of year. Now that's a Hanukkah feast about as healthy as coronavirus. By the way, bunuelos in Sephardic tradition are associated with manna in the Torah. You know, manna from heaven. They taste very much like a heavenly treat, too, if you haven't had them. The point of all this tasty frying, of course, is based on the miracle of the small cruse of oil used to relight the great menorah in the temple in Jerusalem by the Maccabees. And it was supposed to last, that oil, just one night, but miraculously lasted for 8 nights. It's a beautiful story in the Talmud, and a reminder of the need for light during our shortest days of the year, a way to brighten up the long, dark nights with the shining flame of divine rescue. In this very weird year, Hanukkah brings something unique, a promise of light, salvation, and redemption, the hope of brilliant light dispelling the deep darkness of this misbegotten 2020 year. And of course, Hanukkah is all about joy, the joy of affirming our own true identity, rejoicing in the pride that our Jewish religious tradition offers, celebrating the great military victory of the few over the many, the weak over the strong, those who worship the true God over those who bow down to kings who pretend to be gods. It's very much about enjoying it all with family and friends, whether in person or through the modern miracles of Facebook or Zoom. Well, you can join me tonight and the remaining nights of Hanukkah wherever you are on Facebook Live or Zoom for candle lighting at 5:30 p.m. Tucson time. I'll light a different Hanukkah menorah every night and tell its story, sing songs, chant the blessings, not necessarily in that order. Light your own menorah with me, of course, or light several of them and appreciate the freedom of religion that's at the heart of Hanukkah and of our American society, too. And don't forget to eat, drink, and enjoy. To play us in this morning, here's a ridiculously cute song by David Diggs. If you know that name, it's because he starred in Hamilton on Broadway as Thomas Jefferson and other characters, won an Emmy, and later a Grammy. I had no idea he was Jewish, even though his name is David. Should have been a tip-off, but he is. And his new Hanukkah song is called A Puppy for Hanukkah. And the video is just as good as the tune on YouTube, but it's better to hear it on Too Jewish. Super fun.
Yeah. Come on. You know what I want to.
What you want? What you want? What you want? What you want? What you want?
I want a puppy for Hanukkah.
Want a puppy? Want a puppy? Want a puppy? Want a puppy? Want a puppy?
And I'ma get just what I wanted, yep.
Don't get it, don't get it, don't get it, don't get it.
I'ma get a puppy for Hanukkah.
Get a puppy, get a puppy, get a puppy, get a puppy.
Some kids write lists for their Christmas gifts and they send them all off to their Santas. But I don't trip off a list for my gift. I'ma get it cause I got 8 chances. That's right, 8 nights, festival of lights. Go hard for a week with a plus one. So y'all keep stressing, be good, learn lessons. But Hanukkah is the best fun. And you can laugh if you want to. But I'ma get a puppy for Hanukkah. Clarinet, no harmonica. When I get a puppy for Hanukkah. It don't bark, don't bite, don't cry when I shake it, so I'm pretty sure that it's just socks. But you never know, miracles happen, I tap in and start to rip the paper. Oh, please let it be the puppy that I wanted, I don't wanna wait to. Oh, yep, that's just socks. I'ma get what I wanted to.
What you want, 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 what you want.
I'ma get a puppy for Hanukkah.
Get a puppy.
I ain't even tripping on it, bruh.
I ain't on trip.
Cause I'ma get a puppy for Hanukkah. Night two, what it do? Candles get lit.
It's lit.
Latkes, sour cream is the best. It's dip. Applesauce on the side, I might just hit.
Say the bracha first.
I don't know, I ain't gonna trip.
Baruch atarai, Eloheinu melech haolam. Asher kirshanu b'mitzvotav, v'tzivanu lechad leknev. She'el Hanukkah.
That blessing is about, now I've said it. Not sure what it means, but I learned it phonetic. By the way, you got a present for me, is it what I wanted? Pass that shamus, let's get the flame started. Ooh, for me? Oh, well, you shouldn't have. I guess I'll just, Oh, that's a sweater. Did somebody knit this? It's really great. This isn't going how I saw it, huh?
It ain't going well, it ain't going well.
I really hope I get this puppy for Hanukkah. A puppy for Hanukkah.
Give me that dog.
Lights keep burning and nights just pass. Menorah is now covered up with wax. I thought it would be obvious, I didn't want to ask. But will tonight be the night I get my puppy at last? My feet are warm and my body is cozy. The hats and the mittens and umbrella are totally great. Love it all, I'm the king of style. There's one thing I've been wanting all this while. Wait, is that? Could it be? Oh my gosh! You're everything I ever wanted for.
You are what I want. You are what I want.
You are what I want. You're my puppy, Veronica.
Come on, puppy, come on, puppy, come on, puppy, come on, puppy.
I'ma name you Monica.
That's probably not. That's a weird name for a dog.
But it rhymes with Hanukkah.
That was A Puppy for Hanukkah by David Diggs. Very cool song. Whether or not you get or want a puppy for Hanukkah. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, Rabbi Mark Diamond will explain how the relationship, the contemporary one, between Jews and Mormons is developed and the lessons we can learn from the Latter-day Saints and how the new book, Covenants and Communities, came to be co-published by a Jewish rabbinic group and BYU Press. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a wonderful array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. During these days of coronavirus SARS, a small group can join us in person Friday night or Saturday morning. Just email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson. Or you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m. on Facebook Live, all with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, B-E-I-T-S-I-M-C-H-A, Tucson. We'll hold our services with full music by virtual experience weekly, as well as our small, in-person, masked, and very careful attendees. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access those by emailing us, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is also available in blended formats, some people live and some on Zoom. Just for Hanukkah this year, I'm hosting a daily Facebook Live and Zoom program showing off one of the many Hanukkah menorahs from my collection of, maybe 100 of them, telling its story, then doing the blessings, lighting, and songs and stories for you. Tune in on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, or on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, also taught on Zoom and in person, and of course all of our services on Facebook Live, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, that's BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest-growing synagogue in its beginning exciting years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Mark Diamond is a senior lecturer on Jewish studies at Loyola Marymount University. He teaches curriculum courses in a variety of Jewish subjects. In addition, he's professor of practical rabbinics at the Academy for Jewish Religion. Previously, he was the executive director of the Board of Rabbis of Southern California and directed the Los Angeles region of the American Jewish Committee, among many other important positions. He's here today to talk about a new book, Understanding Covenants and Communities, Jews and Latter-day Saints in Dialogue. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, you know, I'll tell you a quick story. When I was embarking on I went on a sabbatical trip around the world, visited the holy places of all the religious places in the world, and the last one I saved after I came back from that trip was going to Salt Lake City and meeting with the Mormons. And before I went, just a week or two before, there was a post, What Jews Can Learn from Mormons: Insights from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, published by you and Steve Wendmuller, another past guest of Two Jewish. And it was extremely helpful to me. Tell me about how all of this dialogue began and what the process was for you.
Of course. I began taking trips to Salt Lake City and Provo, Utah, the site of Brigham Young University, when I was at the Board of Rabbis of Southern California. And I was struck by how, with so many interfaith dialogues that I and others have been part of for many years, there really had not been a serious academic dialogue between a group of Jewish academics and Latter-day Saint academics. So in 2015, when Stephen and I published that article, after a visit to Salt Lake City in Provo, we met subsequently with several colleagues from BYU. As so often happens, these dialogues begin with relationships, and we struck up a friendship with several members of the faculty of Brigham Young University. They came down to Los Angeles to meet with Stephen and with me, and also with Tamar Frankel, who is past president of the Academy for Jewish Religion California. And we approached the subject, what could we do to strengthen interfaith relations between our two communities? And one thing led to another. Beginning in 2016, we launched a series of dialogue sessions, of conferences, both in Los Angeles and in Utah as well. We've had 8 of them to date, highlighted last year by an amazing conference in Jerusalem. It was always our dream to take the group to Jerusalem, and thanks to some generous funding, we were able to meet in Israel for several days. We've again had 8 conferences to date, including one just earlier this month in November. And we think we have hopefully made a dent in strengthening relations, not only between the scholars who are part of this dialogue, but in strengthening relations between our two faith communities. We set out to do not only our own intimate, if you will, private interfaith dialogues on a variety of subjects, but also to have public sessions to bring together Jews and Latter-day Saints in dialogue. And out of those first set of dialogues came this book published earlier this year. We're delighted that the book is, to the best of our knowledge, the first volume ever co-published by a Jewish publisher, Central Conference of American Rabbis, and the Religious Studies Center of Brigham Young University.
It's really quite fascinating. We will talk much more with Rabbi Mark Diamond about the book Understanding Covenants Communities and the relationship between Jews and Latter-day Saints when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, with over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. One more Hanukkah song for you today, Michelle Citrin's Pass the Candle from Left to Right.
Tonight we light the Hanukkah candles from left to right.
Left to right.
We celebrate our victory, we celebrate our rights. First you take a single candle, and you start it with a spark. Then you pass it all around the world, bring light into the dark. You just want to light the rest. All around the world, people gather on this day. A miracle's happening, so we light a candle and say,
tonight,
we light the Hanukkah candles from left to right. Tonight, we light the Hanukkah candles from left to right.
I said to
That was Michelle Citron's cute song for Hanukkah, Pass the Candle. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Nagorno-Karabakh, this awful war area now between Armenia and Azerbaijan. You talked a lot about the Armenian community and the lack of Jews. That's not true of Azerbaijan.
Azerbaijan, Baku in particular, has always had a large, diverse Jewish community. And there's also a small ethnic group called the Mountain Jews living in the northern part of the country. Right. I have no idea how numerous they are, how significant they are.
I've met some in Israel, actually. It's an interesting group, different language, very different culture.
But I think it's fairly small.
Correct.
In any case, religion apart, which is hard to do in this case, Armenia has always been sort of a client state of Russia, and Azerbaijan has always been sort of a client state of Turkey. The Azeri language is essentially the same as Turkish. I mean, there's
Turkic in like, origin.
Yeah. No, it's virtually, I mean, it's like British English and American English. It's very close. Different alphabet, but very close languages. The difference between this current chapter and this particularly destructive chapter of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict and all the previous chapters is that both Russia and Turkey are more overtly involved on the side of their clients. And Turkey could, if it really wanted to get nasty, bring what they see as Russian aggression. I mean, in this round, it may well be the Azeris and or the Russians who started things. Again, they had been quiescent for a while, although, you know, and there was always a group working on this called the Minsk Group. It was one of these kind of perpetual conflicts that occasionally reached a flashpoint. The last time it reached a flashpoint was in the early 90s, and I didn't realize that it was still simmering on the stove until recent hostilities broke out. But if Turkey wanted to, it could go to NATO and invoke Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, which says that every member state will treat an attack on any other member state as an attack on themselves and will come to aid that state as if they too had been attacked. So actually, immediately after 9/11, the U.S. considered going to NATO and saying, we're invoking Article 5, you have to come to our aid, except that there was no state enemy. I mean, the enemy was a movement and it was terrorism, but it wasn't state. So it would have been hard to ask Germany or France or England to help us with that. Now, however, Turkey would be well within its rights, although the distinction actually is that so far Turkey itself hasn't been attacked. Turkish territory hasn't been attacked. Its client state has been attacked, and it's fighting a proxy war with Russia. But if Turkey were to be attacked or even hit by a stray bomb or whatever, the invocation of Article 5 by Turkey would put the U.S. in a terrible position, regardless of when this happens, regardless of who's president. You either have to basically abrogate the North Atlantic Treaty, which spells the end of NATO, or you have to go to war against Russia, which quickly risks escalating into World War III.
With nuclear weapons involved. It's such a weird thing. Religion plays a part too, right?
Well, that's the essence of it.
You know, Russia and Armenia, Christian countries, and Azerbaijan and Turkey, Muslim countries.
Right.
But it's interesting that the Muslim countries are actually on the NATO side in this case.
Well, they're not on the NATO side.
Well,
the Muslim superpower is a member of NATO.
Right.
None of the other states involved is.
Tom, very complicated. Thanks for clarifying it insofar as it can be clarified. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Today, for you, two jokes. Such a deal. A guy buys his wife a beautiful diamond ring for Hanukkah. Hearing about this extravagant gift, a friend asks him, I thought she wanted one of those sporty four-wheel drive vehicles. She did, he replies. But where was I going to find a fake Jeep? And one day, about this time of year, Harry says to his wife, so I suppose you'll be wanting a Hanukkah present. His wife answers, Harry, I want a divorce. And Harry says, I wasn't planning on spending that much. Those were the old Jewish jokes of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In this week's portion of Miketz, we're in the midst of the fabulous story of Joseph, now shorn of his technicolor dream coat and locked away in an Egyptian prison. Here, dreams again play a central role, not for the first time in Genesis, not for the first time in the Joseph story. In Miketz, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, dreams a famous dream. Seven fat cows emerge from the Nile River and then are eaten by seven skinny cows. Then seven fat ears of grain are devoured by seven lean ears of grain. What does it all mean? None of the Egyptian king's brilliant advisors and counselors can help. Apparently, his cabinet selection team has failed him. In desperation, he turns to a forgotten Hebrew prisoner who once helped his chief wine steward, that is, his bartender, when he was in jail with him. Joseph is dragged from prison, cleaned up, brought to the Pharaoh, perhaps the most powerful man in the whole world at that time. He hears the dream, and Joseph correctly interprets it, prophesying 7 years of plenty to be followed by 7 years of famine. Giving full credit to God for being his only source of insight, Joseph helps Pharaoh save Egypt, and things go well for both Joseph and Egypt. He rises to prominence, great prominence, second in command of the whole country, and the Pharaoh's power is multiplied while his people are saved from destruction. Joseph marries and has two children, but oddly, his great success, his fame throughout Egypt and his new family aren't quite enough for him. Joseph misses his father left behind in Canaan, Jacob, and pines for his younger brother Benjamin, the only living reminder of his dead mother, Rachel. He never expects to see his father or full brother again. But then, in a plot twist worthy of our finest novelists, his brothers are compelled by famine to come down to Egypt to buy bread. Suddenly, the same characters who beat him and sold him into slavery are completely in his power. An amazing opportunity for revenge. And in this week's Torah portion of Miketz, Joseph seems to be taking advantage of that. He teases and torments his brothers, he fully aware of their identity and they completely ignorant of his. What will happen? As the Torah portion concludes, we're left wondering just which way it will go. Next week, we'll get the answer. But this week, the issue is clearly delineated. How exactly will a fully assimilated Jew respond to pressure to continue to hide his identity? Or to reveal it. Just as the Jews in the days of the Maccabees struggled with tremendous pressure to accept cultural subjugation and give up Judaism, so too Joseph struggled with hiding his own identity and admitting it to the public. In a season in which the majority culture can overwhelm us with its songs, foods, and religious trappings, we Jews too sometimes struggle to assert our pride in our own Jewish identities. May we learn from the lessons of Joseph and the Maccabees that Jewish identity must be asserted proudly and with commitment, even in the darkest of days. Happy Hanukkah. When we return on to Jewish in a moment, our guest, Rabbi Mark Diamond, will explain how the new Jewish-Mormon relationship developed, what we share and what we can learn from one another. All that when we return on Two Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A Jewish doctor from Boston on the front line of that city's coronavirus response is President-elect Joe Biden's choice to helm the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. Rochelle Walensky, chief of infectious diseases at Mass General Hospital, a professor at Harvard Medical School, was among the members of the new government healthcare team announced last week. The Biden transition team said Walensky is a leading expert on virus testing, prevention, and treatment. Walensky, a member of Temple Emmanuel in Newton, Massachusetts, told Boston's Jewish Journal that she was seeking solace in her Jewish community as she faced down the disease. "I said to them the last time I spoke with them, I'm thinking I need you more than you need me," Walensky said. "I have a sense it's getting emotionally pretty hard. I certainly have everybody's cell number. I may need to use it in the weeks ahead." Biden's rollout was notable for the number of positions he is tying to the battle against COVID. Biden campaigned on incumbent President Donald Trump's failure to stem the spread of the pandemic. Also named as coordinator of the COVID-19 response and counselor to the president is Jeff Zients, an economist who owns a chain of Jewish delis in Washington, D.C. The preeminent Israel lobby AIPAC does not oppose the sale of F-35 stealth fighters to the United Arab Emirates, a sign the Trump administration has sold the Israeli government and its U.S. supporters on a deal that not so long ago they vigorously opposed. We do not oppose the proposed arms sale to the UAE, given the peace agreement reached between Israel and the UAE, as well as the agreement reached between the U.S. and Israel to ensure Israel's qualitative military edge, QME is the abbreviation, will not be adversely impacted by the sale, said Marshall Whitman, spokesman for AIPAC. Whitman's comment came the same day that one of the most hawkish pro-Israel groups, the Jewish Institute for the National Security of America, endorsed the sale, and days after Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Ron Dermer, appeared on TV with his UAE counterpart on MSNBC and did the same. Trump administration, particularly Donald Trump's son-in-law and top advisor, Jared Kushner, have been pushing hard for this sale in the administration's final days. President-elect Joe Biden has not said whether he would reverse the deal if it's not in place by January 20th when he assumes office. Some congressional Democrats have initiated legislation to thwart the deal. News of the sale leaked months ago following the August announcement of Israel and the Emirates normalizing ties, spurring Israeli leaders like Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu to express opposition to the deal. AIPAC backed at least one of the Democratic congressional bids to limit the scope of the arms sale to the UAE at the time. Trump administration officials have sought to persuade Israel and other skeptics that the jets are needed to present a united front against Iran, that Israel will be able to preserve its qualitative military edge in the region in spite of the deal. Israel for decades has opposed advanced arms sales even to friendly Arab states because of the region's instability and the fear that hostile actors could obtain control of the weapons, you know, like terrorists. Has the state of Israel made contact with aliens? According to retired Israeli general and current professor Chaim Eshed, author of a new book, the answer is yes, but it's been kept secret because, quote, humanity isn't ready. Speaking in an interview with the Israeli popular newspaper Yediot Ahronot last week, Eshed, who served as the head of Israel's space security program for nearly 30 years and is a three-time recipient of the Israel Security Award, Eshed explained that Israel and the U.S. have both been dealing with aliens for years. This does not mean immigrants, by the way. Eshed clarified that there was a Galactic Federation in existence. The 87-year-old former space security chief gave further descriptions about exactly what sort of agreements have been made between aliens and the U.S., which ostensibly were made because they wish to research and understand the fabric of the universe. This cooperation includes a secret underground base on Mars, where there are American and alien representatives working right now. If true, this would coincide with U.S. President Donald Trump's creation of the Space Force as the fifth branch of the U.S. Armed Forces, though it is kind of unclear how long this sort of relationship has been going on between the U.S. and the Galactic Federation and its reported extraterrestrial allies. But Eshed insists Trump is aware of them and that he was on the verge of disclosing their existence. However, the Galactic Federation reportedly stopped him from doing so, saying they wished to prevent mass hysteria, since they felt humanity needed to evolve and reach a stage where we will understand what space and spaceships are, said the Yediot Ahronot account. I'm not sure what's more unlikely, that aliens are in regular contact with President Trump or that President Trump managed to keep an actual secret. As for why Eshed has chosen to reveal this incredibly important information now, he explained that the timing was simply due to how much the academic landscape has changed and how respected he is in academia, or was. If I had come up with what I'm saying today 5 years ago, I would have been hospitalized, he explained. He added that today they're already talking differently. I have nothing to lose. I've received my degrees and awards. I am respected in universities abroad where the trend is also changing. Or perhaps today the hospitals are just full with COVID patients and they don't have room for him. Professor Eshed provided more information in his newest book, The Universe Beyond the Horizons, Conversations with Professor Chaim Eshed, along with other details such as how aliens have prevented nuclear apocalypses and when we can jump in and visit the Men in Black. The book is available now in Hebrew. The newspaper interviewer deadpans, it is unclear if any evidence supports Eshed's claims. Well, to find out, you can just wait until the aliens take over the Earth and meet them for yourself. Gracious. Just how does Israel pick its top space scientists anyway? And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Mark Diamond, who's senior lecturer at Loyola Marymount University in Judaic Studies and a professor of practical rabbinics at the Academy of Jewish Religion. For a long time, the executive vice president of the Board of Rabbis of Southern California, and he also directed the LA region of the American Jewish Committee. The book that he has published in coordination with Brigham Young University, Understanding Covenants and Communities, Jews and Latter-day Saints in Dialogue, came out this year. We're talking about the relationship of Jews and Mormons. You know, for some reason, I've always had Mormon friends, had relationships with Mormons, went to junior high school in Los Angeles up the street from the big Mormon temple there. That's just kind of anecdotal, but one of the things I've always noticed is Mormons and Jews have a shared history of persecution. Did that come out at all in your explorations with that?
Absolutely. I think the Latter-day Saints or Mormons and Jews have a number of things in common. We have a shared history, as you noted, of persecution, and we also have a shared history of, if you will, exodus. And entry into a promised land for Mormons, for Latter-day Saints. Utah Valley is their Zion. They take that very seriously. So there are many, many parallels. I also think one of the commonalities between our faith communities is that we cherish family. Family endeavors are so important. I'm sure you know that Latter-day Saints set aside Monday evening.
Monday night, that's right. Yep.
Monday night, family time.
Taffy pulls and games and all kinds of stuff. Prayer, study, yep.
Of course, there's Sunday Sabbath, and we have Shabbat. I'm struck by the fact that we speak often, as you know, in interfaith circles of holy envy, what we admire and appreciate about the other's faith tradition. I'm struck by the fact that when, a couple of years ago, church elders decided to launch a campaign to reinvigorate their Sunday Sabbath worship, one of their leaders spent an entire Shabbat with a traditional Jewish family to see how, if you will, Jews make Shabbos. And I was very struck by that there are things that Mormons feel they can learn from Jews, and certainly many things that we can learn from Latter-day Saint faith tradition, even though it's a much younger tradition.
I'm trying to teach my congregation about tithing. It came from Judaism, but the Latter-day Saints practice it religiously, if you will. Jews, not so much.
Oh, my goodness. I certainly have holy envy of tithing. Just yesterday, I had a very dear friend, Dr. Andrew Reed, who is the co-editor of the book that we referenced. Mm-hmm. And Andy came and spoke via Zoom, of course, with my Loyola Marymount students. And I said, now I want you all to be sure that you're sitting down. What do you think tuition is at Brigham Young University compared to what you pay at LMU, which is a wonderful Jesuit school? And he shot them all. But the reason they're able to do that is precisely because Mormon families tithe religiously. And that money goes to support the worldwide church endeavors, including a very fine university in Provo, Utah.
And the essays in the book, of course, also, but in your initial exploration, you know, one of the things that comes out so clearly is the Mormon church is highly organized and very specifically organized, as opposed to any Jewish movement today. Is there something that Jews can learn from Mormons about that?
Well, I think we can learn both how to have how a centralized authority also works with a decentralized authority. As I've studied Latter-day Saint traditions and visited many communities, including those, by the way, in Arizona, I'm struck by the fact that, yes, the words, the leadership comes down and is passed down from Salt Lake City, but there's also a striking amount of decentralization in the church. Local bishops really have tremendous autonomy to run things as they see fit. And as you well know, Mormons do not have ordained clergy. These are all volunteer positions. So it is very much, in many respects, a top-down hierarchical structure, and yet very decentralized. Most of the decision-making I have found is left on the local level. And as, of course, as you noted, we Jews, we don't deal well with centralized authority.
No.
Every rabbi is his or her own, and congregation operates on their own.
The essays in the book also highlight some of the ways, I mean, so much of the original Latter-day Saint structuring is taken from not New Testament, but Tanakh, but Old Testament sources, in terms, including the way they structure their temple. They've kind of tried to recreate some aspects of biblical Jewish worship, but there are certain kind of flashpoints between, not, I don't know, flashpoints, but clear differences, obviously, between Jews and Mormons. Can you talk about some of those as well?
Of course. First, I would just reiterate what you said a moment ago, that Mormons really take the Old Testament very seriously. If any of your listeners ever have the opportunity to visit a Latter-day Saint temple before it is dedicated, it is an extraordinary experience.
It is amazing. Some people in my congregation did have that opportunity because they opened a Mormon temple here in Tucson just a few years ago. I got to turn over one of the spades at the dedication, and then once it was open, you could tour it before it was dedicated, of course.
Exactly, and it is. I had the pleasure of, I visited three Mormon temples before their dedication, including one in Gilbert, Arizona, not far from you.
Not far,
no. And it is really, as you say, a wonderful experience.
By the way, their workmanship is amazing. Just incredible.
And each temple has its own local flavor and culture to it. Not that they have many common features, but also there's a kind of a regional cultural flavor to each one, which I admire and appreciate. Now on to some of those flashpoints, because as we've gotten further along in our dialogue with our Latter-day Saint colleagues, we have tackled some of the more sensitive issues. One we tackle in the book is supersessionism. There is a history of some supersessionist theology in Mormonism, the notion that as many, and this is, of course, a traditional Christian view, that Christianity has superseded or replaced or fulfilled Judaism. There is some element of that in Latter-day Saint theology, and we discuss that in the book. Maybe perhaps not as prominent as you see to this day in some Christian circles. Another a major flashpoint is the question of posthumous baptism. Some years ago, this rose to the forefront when it was revealed that erstwhile zealous Mormons, if you will, were entering their temples and were posthumously baptizing victims of the Holocaust. Jews like Daniel Pearl, for example, and this created an understandable outrage in the Jewish community. I can say that I've discussed this with church elders, and we've discussed this with colleagues in the Jewish Latter-day Saint Dialogue Project. And as of now, it is a Mormon who enters a temple anywhere in the world can only posthumously baptize his or her own ancestors, relatives. You can't just go in and say, I want to baptize Rabbi Mark Diamond's grandfather. Simply not allowed anymore. So I think the church responded to this issue. They recognized that while this ceremony of posthumous baptism is a very important feature of their belief system, to allow people to do this just willy-nilly is, in this case, very offensive to the Jewish community.
Which also demonstrates, I think, some of the kind of fascinating and surprising flexibility from a pretty strongly traditional, if that's the right word for it, religious community like the Latter-day Saints. They've shown a cleverness also and an ability to adapt. You make a point. I remember going to see the Book of Mormon, a very funny, very good musical, which you'd think would be radically offensive to all Mormons. And in there they had an ad, you know, you've seen the play, now read the book, or the book is always better. They treated it with humor.
Yes, I find that a fascinating contrast with a typical, what I would say, Jewish communal response. If there were a play called the Book of Torah or the Book of Tanakh, which was as offensive to us as Jews as the Book of Mormon clearly is to Latter-day Saints, I would imagine the Jewish response would be, every organization would be vying to take out full-page ads in the New York Times condemning this. We'd have a protest outside all the theaters across the country. And we, in good Jewish fashion, we would Schweigewalt.
Absolutely. And you're with the American Jewish community. I mean, you know, right, that there's certainly that would be the response.
Yes, absolutely. And an understandable response. I think to the great credit of church elders, they realized they weren't going to defeat this phenomenon. So I think they decided, look, let's see if we can turn a negative into a positive. And it seems to have worked. And I applaud them for this particular response to the Book of Mormon.
There's an important BYU campus in Jerusalem, highly controversial when it was built, very strong restrictions on it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. And as I mentioned earlier, I had the pleasure and honor of being on that campus several times, including last summer when we held our conference in Jerusalem and met it at Hebrew Union College, at the Shalom Harmon Institute, and at BYU Jerusalem Center for a marvelous keynote presentation. But you're absolutely right. The building of that center, a beautiful spot there on the Mount of Olives, caused great controversy because voices in Israel said, many individuals, many leaders said, look, the Latter-day Saint is a missionary community, missionary faith. How can you allow them to come here and proselytize Jews? And the agreement, which was signed, clearly says that in Israel, Mormons will not dispatch missionaries. And indeed, to this very day, the students who study there from BYU and anybody else who's there on the faculty religiously, zealously avoid any efforts at proselytizing. If you were to ask a BYU student in Jerusalem who's there for a semester, tell me about your faith, the response is, not going to talk about it. You can go online if you want, but I'm not going to talk about it. I'll share a cute story that Yossi Klein Halevi, the wonderful, renowned journalist and senior fellow at the Harmon Institute, spoke to our group last summer. And the first thing he said to the BYU faculty who were with us, he said, I want to know more about you. Nobody will talk about your faith here in Israel. And I thought it was a lovely way of reminding the group that, you know, I appreciate the prohibition of this, but nobody will tell me what it is to be a Mormon in Israel. And that's indeed the case. They take this very seriously. So, the controversy seems to have turned into a positive development over time.
Latter-day Saints are growing everywhere in the world. There are approximately the same number of Mormons as there are Jews in the world, although the number of Latter-day Saints, because of their active proselytizing everywhere else outside of Israel, is growing quite rapidly or fairly rapidly most places. Jews are stagnant in growth. Is there something we can learn from their approach to, for want of a better term, Kiruv or Geirut?
Well, it's a wonderful question. I don't see us suddenly becoming a missionary faith or community. We've been out of that business for a long time. I actually would flip the question, if I may. I think there's something they can learn from the Jewish community. Mormons are now living in many cases in what for them would be diaspora communities. If you live as a Latter-day Saint in Utah, you've got a lot of Mormons, okay? Professor Andrew Reed, I mentioned earlier, he's a bishop as you know in his local church ward. His ward is five blocks in Utah. That's 500 individuals, right? You know, it's not that challenging to be a Mormon. in Salt Lake City, okay, or in many areas of Utah.
Just like it's kind of easy to be Orthodox in Jerusalem.
Well, exactly. And so my point is, I think as the Mormon faith expands around the world and it is growing, what is it like to be a Mormon in Los Angeles, where there are a fair number of Latter-day Saints, but not huge numbers? What's it like to be a Latter-day Saint in other communities, in foreign countries? So I think they have the challenge that we Jews have known well from our history, which is, you know, what is it like? How can you build a rich and fulfilling, in this case, Mormon life in diaspora when you're far from a temple and far from a large, significant community of Latter-day Saints?
I want to thank Rabbi Mark Diamond for a great visit. I feel like we could talk for a very long time on this subject. Book is called Understanding Covenants and Communities, Jews and Latter-day Saints in Dialogue. It's co-published by the Central Conference of American Rabbis and by the BYU Press. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the book?
Thank you. Well, you can just go to the CCAR Press website or to the website of the Religious Studies Center of BYU, or you could even find the book on Amazon.
Where all things are sold.
Indeed.
Mark, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. And in advance, a happy Hanukkah. May it be a better year for all of us.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to be with you, and best of luck to you and your listeners.
Thank you. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes for Hanukkah, since we're on a Star Wars kind of theme today, from our weird news story about the Israeli retired head of the space program who is sure there is extraterrestrial contact with the Galactic Federation. So, in his honor, it's 6/13's A Star Wars Hanukkah. Don't miss my nightly candlelighting every night of Hanukkah at 5:30 on Facebook Live. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information, or to our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson. And join us next Sunday. Our guest on Two Jewish will be Amy Schwartz, author of the fascinating new book, Can Robots Be Jewish? And Other Pressing Questions of Modern Life. My friends, may you have a wonderful holiday of Hanukkah. It continues every night through Thursday night and, I guess, Friday day. Have a Chag Urim Sameach and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Rock of ages, praise your saving power. Furious, they assailed, but your armor veiled us. And your word broke the sword when our own strength failed us. Yes, your word broke the sword when our own strength failed us. Rock of ages, let our song praise your saving power. Lord God, Sufganya. Happy Hanukkah, Lord God, Sufganya.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.